Welcome to Air Crew Interview. I'm Mike Young, your host, and this is another one of our Q&A sessions we hold via our YouTube channel, which allows our viewers and followers to ask past guests anything about their flying career. This time we were joined by former F-111 pilot Jeff Gwynn. So if you like what we do here, head over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us out for as little as $1 per month. Or you can donate by going to aircrewinterview.tv/donate. Thank you and enjoy.
See, I see Sean Everton wants to know that if we had compressor stall problems with the TF-30 engines like they did in the F-14, and that would be a big yes. If we had the airplane G'd up at all going into afterburner, you stood a 50-50 chance of compressor stalling the engine. And the fix for it typically was to you just pull the throttle back to idle power and it would recover. But it was very, very common. I probably had that happen 30 times over the time I flew the airplane. One time we actually had to shut the engine down and restart it to recover the engine. And one time I had it on the tanker, just tapped a little bit of burner to get in position on the tanker when I was a brand new guy, and the motor popped and off we went. But I did read that happened because of the engine that the F-14 wanted, it wasn't ready quite in time. They got stuck with the TF-30s. And for the F-14, that had to have been a much bigger problem because they were much more maneuvering kind of air-to-air fighter than we were. Let's see. The craziest thing a student did, which left me bewildered. That's a tough one. And it's tough without getting a little bit of trouble, I suppose. I flew as a pilot training instructor with the Navy. And I had a female student, start crying, in the pattern. And it really wasn't kind of lost the bubble. She wasn't really doing that badly. And I was never one of the fear and sarcasm and ridicule sort of instructors. At least I tell myself that. And I never talked to the students when they were flying the airplane, because I know from my own personal experience, when I get task saturated, the very first thing to go is the audio channel. And if somebody were to ask me, which do you prefer, eggs or purple dreams, I'd say yes. She did have a bit of an emotional event in the airplane, and I took the airplane flew a few bounces, and then she was better and pressed on. And it's, I think, just one of those things that we're not all the women and men aren't the same, behavior that you, anyway, I'm not going to get any deeper in that subject. That was kind of the weirdest thing I ever saw happen. I had another student who I washed out, just try to plant the airplane in the on the numbers. And so that wasn't a washout ride anyway, but that's kind of more standard stuff. But I never really had any students do anything that left me bewildered, because mostly you can sort of see, have so much more experience than the student does, that if the student does something that surprises me, then I'm not keeping up. And I never had that happen. John Ellis asks if the F-111 was the right airplane for the RAAF, and I'd have to say no. I'm not sure that the F-111 is really the right airplane for anybody. And it's not that the airplane, it was a great airplane, it was a great performer, but its original design was simply unachievable. And it's almost an accident, in a sense, that it was that ever was as good as it became at what it did. And the reason I say that is because it was specified to do some things that we never did, weren't useful in our role, and compromised the design of the airplane. The requirement for the F-111 to go supersonic it meant that it had to have more fuel because it had to have a range commitment to keep up with. And So those things combined to make it heavier. And at the same time, it forced an airframe design that really wasn't the best design for the subsonic realm in which we nearly always were, except when we were doing make-believe at Red Flag. And I think the Buccaneer really was in some ways, it wasn't as modern an airplane. It didn't have the range and the speed and some other things, but a Buccaneer or the A6 maybe was even better. If they could have been given some of the performance that we had, a little bit more speed and a lower altitude TFR and things like that. Let's see. Oliver asks, was it standard practice to listen to rock music while flying? Well, my particular weakness was listening, and I think it probably came through. I put up a couple videos, but I like to listen to the BBC World Service. And so there'd always be, we had an HF radio in the airplane, so we just dial up an HF frequency, whatever, you know, whatever we want to listen to. Some of the whistles like listening to rock music. And there's a German rock station we listened to a lot. And I like was listening to BBC World Service. So yeah, I guess it was kind of a, we just tuned the HF to those frequencies and then just opened up the comm channel to it. We didn't have to do anything special to it at all. Let me see. As for the most vivid memory of being on deployment, well, that's a tough one to answer. I'd have to, aside from the flying, it would probably be some of the hijinks that we got up to when we were in Turkey. Some of the guys one day decided they stole the supervisor of flying's truck, some of my fellow Tigers, and they kind of lined the bed with some plastic trash bags, filled it with water, and then they drove around the base, perhaps not wearing as much as they might have done. That might have been an alcohol-involved incident when it was all said and done. Let's see. I did all my flying out of, I can't even pronounce that. Ectalion asked if I flew out of Upper Hayford and you went to school at Brackley, close to Groton. We had a lot of our friends lived in Brackley. Yeah, I flew out of RAF Upper Hayford for 7 years total. And I'm just wondering if he remembers when the Committee Against Nuclear Disarmament, CND, when they tried to close down the base. I just wonder if he was around and remembers that, because I have a bit of a story about that. John wants to know if I ever grabbed the arresting cable on F-111. And I did once. I was taken off at Upper Hayford, and right about rotation speed, I think we're actually about 160 knots, right around liftoff. So I rotated and just getting ready to come off the ground, and this giant raven, not the F-111, but the bird, flew in right just inches off the ground, coming across the runway from left to right. And I thought, oh, great, I'm going to be the first guy to hit a bird and with an airplane and not even be in the air. And what happened was that the left engine just hoovered that bird right up into the intake. It was a big bird, and it compressor stalled the motor so hard that flames went shooting by the cockpit on my side. The supervisor of flying was going to yell, abort, 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 except he didn't hail the microphone. And they actually heard the boom as far away as what's the town just south of Upper Hayford? I can't remember offhand. Anyway, they heard the thing from several miles away. And so I did what we did at the time, which was reject the takeoff. Quite a stupid thing to do, actually, but that was our guidance. And so I yanked the throttles to idle, and there was a warning in dash one that said, in the flight manual, said, if you lock up the wheels, we had anti-skid, so that wasn't supposed to happen. If you lock up the wheels, you'll shred the tires, you'll cross the cable with nothing but bare rims, and you'll part the cable, and then it won't do you any good. So here I've done a very high speed abort. Then I don't use a lot of brakes. I cross the cable probably at about 100, 120 knots. And if the cable hadn't have caught me, I'd have been off the end of the runway into the Cherwell Valley and some poor old lady's house on the other side of Airfield Road. And it was really, there was many stupid things that we did there. And I know Mike's told me to keep it to 2 minutes, but I'm going to have to go a little bit past it on this one. We calculated numbers that bore no resemblance to reality in that we would tell ourselves that we could reject a takeoff up to about 160 knots and stop on the available runway without noting what the conditions were that made those numbers useful. In that once you rotate the airplane, your induced drag goes way up, your acceleration goes way down. So every number you have after that is pointless. And I could go into more reasons why we probably didn't have these events happen very often, but ultimately I should have just taken the airplane in the air. It would have been far less risky to bring it, take it airborne and deal with the engine rather than try and stop it on the ground. And as it turned out, the motor recovered itself. It was idling perfectly happily when we finally stopped the motor and the airplane and the fire department shows up. The motor was idling just fine. Stank like hell, because that's what toasted Raven smells like. But anyway, yeah, I did take a cable. And it wasn't that big a stop. It was nice that I knew I wasn't going to go off the end of the runway. It wasn't like it yanked my, like my head went forward. I have done, I've been in the back seat of a T-45 landing on a carrier. And that's an arrested landing. That one gets your attention. Let me see. Let's see, where have I gone here? John asks if being a heavy strike fighter, are you still a fighter? And that's a fair question. I think the real answer to that word is that the Air Force typically assigned the letter F to any aircraft with one or two crew members and one or two engines. Unless, I was a trainer, but if we were in the, in the combat category, just about anything that had that sort of design configuration would be called F. Now there's the A7, the A10, the F-117 really should have been the A-117. And I think given that the role of the F-111 was strictly ground attack, it should have been the A-111. We were not a fighter in any real sense of the word. And throwing an F on the front of it didn't change things any. And kind of goes in what Jeff McQuaid said, which is, why does the Air Force hate the letter A? I don't know. I think it's because for a long time, the institutional Air Force, Tactical Air Command, and then Air Combat Command, really, I think I mentioned that in my original interview, but really, their whole role was to glorify, they want to just glorify air-to-air. And if it didn't glorify air-to-air, they didn't want to know about it. That's why the A-10, despite being a brilliant airplane and absolutely suited for a very necessary mission, that's why the Air Force had tried to kill the thing so many times, because it doesn't glorify air-to-air. I think it's a psychological thing, an institutional thing. It doesn't really make any sense. Martin Ereskog, I hope I'm not mangling that too badly. Would I agree with the agreement? You don't rise to the occasion, but you fall to your level of preparation. Absolutely. It was just as true in flying F-111s that we did an immense amount of preparation before a flight. We briefed everything in detail, and the better our preparation was and the more accurately we had covered things before we went out and flew, inevitably the better it went. And that's same in the airline business. It doesn't have nearly the pacing that it does flying the F-111, but over here in Europe, every airfield is different. They have 17 or 20 different considerations, and the more you know, and the more you've prepared about what you get into, the flight just goes better. There's a really great guy in the 79th. We called him Hudley. And his favorite saying was, thinking weakens the team. And if you prepare, you don't have to think. I have another question about the Viggins, and that was coming from Tactical Leadership Program. The Viggins really probably won the coolest looking airplane on the ramp contest, no doubt about that. But they weren't, I suppose I could say this about most fighters at the time, if they tried to go as fast as we could go, then they didn't have any range. And so we inevitably had to kind of operate by ourselves because we were going 60 to 100 knots faster than any other airplane out there. And when you're dealing with speed differentials of greater than a mile, mile to a mile and a half a minute, that really leaves a mark. And I think at the time, this is in the early 80s, at the time they were an effective airplane, but only barely. I think they were like the F-104 and had pretty much reached the end of their useful service life. Napalm asks if I've ever met Steve Ritchie. No, I think I know I'd be honored to. I've heard the name, great reputation, but no, I've never met him. Here's an interesting question. I did most of my flying in Europe, well, about half of it. And the flying that I did in the States, it was about half of it was up in Mountain Home, Idaho, training new guys. So I didn't get very many flights over the RBS ranges. Zigzag Ground Zero calls them U.S. Western bomb plots. But I think he's referring to what we called RBS ranges. And they'd score you by, you'd have a tone, you'd start a tone on your IP to target run, and then they'd track you on radar, and then they would, when the tone broke, which is when your airplane generated a weapons release signal, then they'd score, then you give you a score that corresponded to the weapon ballistics added from the point where the tone broke. And I wish I could remember the range. We went to one in Colorado a fair amount, but it was always kind of, it was a little bit strange. And that's so long ago, I don't remember it really well, but it wasn't, you know, if you're not dropping actual things off the airplane that leave a mark in the ground, like our training ordnance did, then it just wasn't as much fun. Let's see. John Ellis asks, it was almost like the F-14 ended up what the F-111 supposed to be. I think that's true. I can't remember the name, but I did listen to an interview that Mark did with a guy who was in the F-14 test program. That was probably, 3 weeks ago, Mike? Something like that. Anyway, that guy did a really excellent discussion of what the shortcomings were of the F-111 with respect to the Navy and how the Navy had to come up with something like the F-14 in order for it to work. And he just knows his stuff so well that that portion of the interview gave a far better answer than I could ever have done. Which kind of leads into the next question from Jack Lettingham. Which aircraft would I have loved to have flown? Well, one of them would have to have been, and that's not quite present day, one of them have to have been the F-14. Absolutely the coolest looking combat aircraft ever. Or the F-15E. A lot of the guys who were a little younger than I was, they went on to the F-15E after the F-111. I never got that chance. But I think I would have, of all the airplanes I could have flown out there, the F-15E or the F-14 would have been the two biggest gets that I never really had. I did get a few minutes in an F-15, one flight in F-15 at fighter weapons school, and that just kind of whetted my whistle, as it were, for what the F-15 was like. Hughes JA 1975 asks, how communicative was the airframe with respect to having the sweep set incorrectly, too forward or too aft? If it was too far forward, the airspeed indicator had a barber pole in it, a max Mach, that would pop up, and you would just know that one look inside. If you could see that barber pole, he had the wings too far forward. The problem was when they got too far aft. When the wings at the mid settings at about 30, between about 35 and 50, the airplane would start to burble as we started to reach the high angles of attack. But as the wings got aft of 54 or so, there would be no, there'd be absolutely no sign from the airframe at all that we're nearing a limiting angle of attack. And when I first got into the airplane, there was no real feedback. As you got towards higher angle of attack, the airplane wouldn't tell you that you were getting close to very, very bad things. And that's because, and again, this question, I'm going to answer this one, I have to go a little bit more than a couple minutes. The airplane is the only airplane, operational airplane I know of that would spin before it stalled. And that's because at high angles of attack, even though the wings were past their stall angle of attack, that wide, flat, really fairly flat fuselage was still generating increasing lift. And because the fuselage was so wide to contain all that fuel, at the higher angles of attack, the vertical stabilizer was practically blanked. And the nose of that airplane, in order to fare in the large radar dish, was very long. And so all it would take would be above about 20 degrees AOA. If there was a little bit of divergence, the nose would take over. It would have more yaw command, a destabilizing yaw command than the vertical stabilizer had stabilizing yaw authority, and the airplane would just depart. And it would do that before it stalled, which meant you never had, in a normal airplane, the airplane's designed so that you, the inner part of them, somebody will correct me if I'm wrong. This isn't really my strength here, aerospace engineering, but in most airplanes, the inner part of the wing stalls first, and so the nose will break down, so it will naturally want to reduce AOA. And at the same time, the roll part of the aileron, the wing's designed so the ailerons won't stall, so you retain roll authority, but you lose the pitch authority that's causing the airplane to stall. Well, in the F-111, none of that happened, and the airplane, and this happened many times, the airplane be perfectly happy to spin without bothering to stall first. Let's see, going to other, let's see, the Keith Stewart asks, how different was the F-111E from the 111F? Well, the 111F was what all the 111s should have been. Far more powerful engines. I think I mentioned in the interview that we had about 36,000 pounds of thrust, full burner, both engines. And I think the F-111F was upwards of about 55,000 pounds. So if they got down to about the fuel weight where the crew would start getting really frightened, the airplane would actually have better one-to-one thrust ratio. And in any event, it was the first airplane, the F-111F, that could go supersonic and mill power, which one of them did up at, we had a RBS scoring range on the west coast of Scotland that I can't remember the name of. And an F-111F got in a lot of trouble because they went over the range supersonic and did many damages. And they weren't even they were just in mill power. But the F-111 had very reliable digital avionics. They had the PAVTAC, which means they could have a lot of standoff range with slick weapons. They could throw Mark 84 from about 6 miles off and guide the weapon to a pinpoint target while egressing the target area all at the same time. Brilliant airplane. It's what we should have been. But unfortunately, we were just built 5 or 6 years too soon. Let's see. Next question up. I got to scroll this thing properly. John Ellis asks, could the 111 capsule function properly during a spin? Yes, it has. There was an airplane that spun out of the hold over East Anglia in an exercise in late 1980, I think. They were told to go into a max endurance airspeed, which was below Anyway, many things I could talk about that went wrong, and the airplane got behind the power curve, which on the F-111 was a very scary looking thing. Anyway, it got behind power curve up at altitude. The pilot was concerned that it'd fall right through the stack and hit somebody else on the way down. So he tried to maintain altitude. Airplane departed without stalling and did about two spins, and they went through 10,000 feet and they bailed out. And so he, after they landed, he walked to the nearest pub and said, "Hey, I got to call my squadron. Can I borrow a quid?" So yeah, it did function properly during a spin, but a good friend of mine, my best friend at the time at Cannon Air Force Base when I was there, this had been about 1979, early 1980. I guess it was the summer of 1980. Again, this, I won't take this answer as far as it could go, but they were bringing an airplane back with a shutdown engine, and they got behind the power, that dreaded power curve again on final because it was a hot day in the summer. And when they went to light afterburner, the afterburner wouldn't light. It's a reminds me of a question we had up above. And so the airplane wasn't going to make it to the runway. And they punched out, and the airplane had some yaw in it because it had full male power on one engine, idle power on the other. And I think because the airplane was in mostly level flight, the drogue chute from the capsule got, there's a spin stabilization chute in the capsule. So that when the airplane, when the capsule comes out, the stabilization chute, a drogue chute pops out, and all its only role in life, it's about 4 or 5 feet in diameter, is to keep the capsule pointed for deployment of the main chute. So that means when the main chute comes out of the hopper behind the cockpit, that drogue chute has served its purpose and it should be gotten rid of. Well, that would have cost money, and they didn't ever put any explosive bolts in there to separate the drogue chute when the main chute came out. And that was the second time that a main recovery parachute got hung up in the drogue chute and the guys just hammered into the ground and got killed. So it was a very reliable system in the envelope. And the envelope was as big as the airplane was. I think we hold the world speed record for a Cannon F-111D had a horizontal slab actuator fail during a functional check flight run, and they jumped out about Mach 3 and, you know, walked away from it. In a real airplane, if you'd have done that, the aircrew would have been torn apart. So it did work very well, but there was a couple times when it could have worked better and didn't, because the engineers, they didn't pay the money to do what they to put in the separating drogue chute. Mikko, and I want to say Mika Häkkinen because he sounds like he's from the same country as the F1 world champion, and I can pronounce Häkkinen, but I can't pronounce whatever it is, Vigelainen. I will go with that. Asked what the wartime function of the F-111s were when the threat was a massive invasion against NATO. Our primary function was to attack, to suppress their airfields. So we wanted to crater runways. If we could keep their air arm down, then what we needed to be able to do was to operate against their massed armor formations. And so we needed to take out their fighter and attack airfields in order to make that happen, to make the air superiority role easier to do. So our primary function was to attack airfields in the rear echelon. And that was pretty much it. And then that would get us, we figured that would get us through about a week of the war. And then the Warsaw Pact would be completely overrunning us because we didn't have anything nearly like the fourth strength that the Warsaw Pact did. And then we would have to start looking at other weapons options about which I can either confirm or deny, if you know what I'm saying. Sean wants to know, how did I like side-by-side crew compared to tandem? Not much. the size of the radar dish meant that the front bulkhead of the airplane had to be reasonably large to get the radar, kind of radar display we needed to do accurate attack. And because of that large front bulkhead, that kind of made the airplane go side by side because you have the room for it. And if you put front and back, then the airplane gets longer. And that also was kind of aggravated by building for Navy requirements because they had to keep the airplane as short as possible. I'm not sure we would have had front and back seating in any event, just because the planform of the fuselage was so wide. But with that side-by-side seating, it really limited visibility out of the right side. Sometimes they'd have to fly formation on the left wing. And that was always a bit scary because it was just so much harder to do that looking through the cockpit than looking, you know, cross cockpit was always harder. So I would have vastly preferred front and back seating, but that's not what they gave us.
Jeff, can I just stop you there? Like, how long are you willing to go on for? Because obviously you've got a lot of questions, but we don't want to take up too much of your time.
Okay, well, I'll go on as long as you want to and other people do. I will try and speed up the pace.
No, it's absolutely fine. I'm happy sitting here, and I think we've got like a great thing. Would you like another half an hour? Would you be happy with that?
No, it's fine. I'll just try and keep from being such a windy old blowhard. John Ellis asked if F-15 spun for similar reasons. So far as I know, they didn't. The way you spin an airplane like the F-15 is get to a really high angle of attack and then somehow get a bunch of yaw in the airplane. And even then it won't want to stall or won't want to spin, as opposed to the F-111, which would be happy to do it. An avionics tech who worked on ECM, the F-111, EF-111, how accurate or reliable were the systems we used? When I think the airplane was pretty reliable within the context of the length of a mission. Most of the time, the airplane worked from beginning to end. The ECM seemed to work all the time. That was largely because it was electronic. Anything that was electromechanical wasn't nearly as reliable. And the systems were pretty accurate, as accurate as they could be. The INS in that airplane was analog, and it wasn't accurate. Just wasn't. We didn't have any kind of GPS updating to the airplane. And so that part made it very, very difficult to operate. It was real demand on the right seaters to get that airplane to work as well as it could. The really, really good right seaters could make a huge difference in the airplane. By the time of Desert Storm, we got one or two airplanes in that had updated avionics, GPS, and digital inertials, digital flight control computers, and GPS updating on the inertials, a modern multifunctional control display unit. I mean, it was a thing of genius. And then they retired the airplane a year later. But I do remember that a statistic that the F-111 took about 35 hours of maintenance time per flight hour. So overall, not maybe necessarily between missions, but overall lifetime, if I flew a 2.5 hour sortie, which was typical, it was about 100 maintenance hours was involved somewhere along the line. Kane asked what it was like when the engine failed. I never actually had a situation where I had an engine fail and didn't recover. I had a couple of times where it quit, and then I had to deal with flying it until I got the engine back. I had one case in particular at night where the engine, it was a problem child engine, compressor stalled and just lit up the sky. So a significant amount of yaw at first, but the engines are so close to the center line of the airplane that they didn't really induce much yaw. Compared to an airliner where the engines are further out in the wing, you lose an engine, one of those things, it's a big deal. The F-111, it really wasn't so much. It was pretty easy. Let's see, what about bombing tactics? Low versus... we had to... we pretty much had to drop nuclear weapons with a what we call a low altitude, low angle drogue delivery LAD maneuver. It's because the nuclear weapons are very delicate and they won't handle an impact with the ground very well. So they had to be drogue delivered, and I think we could do a lay down delivery, but sometimes the nature of the target, you had to have the weapon go off in the air. So we had the high speed lay down, but the parachute laid the weapon on the ground, and then the low altitude drogue delivery, we'd have about a 5,000 foot or so range where we do a 4G pull up to about 45 degrees, and the weapons delivery control computer would calculate when to release the weapon, and then we would do a 180-degree roll, pull back down to low altitude, and egress the target straight ahead. But that was all really to kind of keep up with what the weapon needed us to do. Let's see. Gideon asks about the Ivan thanks you very much maneuver. That was something we talked about in Red Flag. I did go over ridges inverted. Typically, unless you were hitting a ridge straight on, you could kind of do a slice back. But yeah, I went over ridges inverted, but that was always hand flying. There was no way that the TFR could handle that. The moment you went past, I think 45 degrees, the TFR, the terrain following radar, couldn't look into the turn enough to know that you were going to clear any obstacles. And so it would give a 4G fly-up maneuver if you did that. So we could never do that in autopilot. And really, it was fun to do, yeah. But was it useful? No. Because there's no way that any air-to-air airplane is going to be down on the deck with us at night trying to shoot us with a heater. It just wasn't going to happen. So, yeah, it was Operation Frequent Manhood, but not tactically applicable, really. Let's see. I keep scrolling here. Helzevec asks, the low-level single-role fighter bomber in a conventional 80s war struck seemed to be suicidal. Had that happened, how do you think the F-111 would have fared? Well, I don't know. I think right towards in the 80s, it would not have been, because the acquisition range without pulse Doppler radars, there were no enemy air-to-air fighters that could see us against the ground. Even target tracking radars on surface-to-air missile systems have a very narrow field of view. And unless they get directed, they get told where to look. They're almost certainly not going to see us. And the missiles they'd be using had a pretty limited range. The SA-8, for instance, had a very limited kinematic range. So it's simply, by the time they could acquire us and launch, by the time that happened, they're almost always going to be with a tail-on aspect, and they simply would run out of propellant before they got to us. The SA-6 would be a different, a more lethal ball of wax in the SA-10s and 12s. I think by that point, that was in the 90s. Then I think we were getting to near suicidal, and that's why we went to low observable airplanes, because the ground was no longer our friend. The most exotic fighter types I mixed with, Hillary Clinton could get away with talking about this sort of stuff, but I can't, perhaps. So I don't know. I may get hauled off to jail before the end of this interview. But during Red Flag, we had an operation where we flew with airplanes that were very, and I mentioned this in the interview, that were very secret, that with the fact we had them. And I think it doesn't matter anymore. So I flew against the MiG-23, MiG-17, and MiG-21. During fighter weapons school. And what impressed me about them was they really weren't very good airplanes. The visibility out of the MiG-21 was horrible, short range, and by the time, it was a pretty good match for the F-4 during Vietnam, but by the time the 1980s, it was completely outclassed by F-16 and F-15. And the MiG-23 was fast, not as fast as we were, And it could, it was, funny thing was, it turned even less well than we did. We did a little bit of DACT against them, and I could always keep my Pipper inside of the MiG-23's turn, and they couldn't do that to us. Mark Asara talked about the hard points in the FB-111, and the FB-111 was a SAC's version of the airplane, and they had to have a huge amount of range on that airplane. So I think the way they configured it was two wing tanks in each wing, and two weapons in the weapons bay. And the problem with that is that the only way you get four on either wing is if you have two in the outboard stations, which are fixed at a 26-degree wing sweep. And so they took off at 16 wing, and it looked goofy as heck because the outboard two tanks on either side are pointing towards the nose of the airplane. They're not pointing straight ahead, so that probably looked really retarded. But after takeoff, they swooped the wings to 26. That would keep the tanks fared with the airstream, and then when the tanks emptied, I think they jettisoned first the tank and then the pylon. So then the airplane would be down to two tanks on either wing with the fared pylons, and they could move because they were getting lighter. They could move the wings back, and those would always fare with the wing sweep. And then when those went dry, they jettison those tanks and then leave the pylons on. So it wasn't, that was a SAC thing. I was in Tactical Air Command, Air Combat Command. We never had them, never used them. Jay Priller asked, what if I was told about issues with the F-111's tail prior to flying it? Yes, we lost airplanes due to it, so we knew about it. But I think by the time I got to the airplane, they'd had a fix in. It had to do with a horizontal stabilizer trim actuator, I think, HSTA. And anyway, it was a kind of a shuttle valve that ported hydraulic fluid to move the horizontal stabilizer. And they could wear in such a way that the piston galled in the bore and they'd seize. And if they seized in a certain position that was anything other than absolutely null, it would continue driving fluid to whatever direction, nose down or up, that until the surface reached its limit. Well, of course, you lose control. But all the airplanes have been lost to that, got lost before I came to the F-111. So, yeah, we knew about them, but thankfully they'd fixed it. The F-111, Hughes J. asked, if with the F-111 being an all-weather attack aircraft, how do you manage missions in icing? You go faster. That's it. We had no, other than engine inlet anti-ice, we had no airframe anti-icing whatsoever. And the cure to it was to simply speed up. Airframe heating would help take care of it. And then the faster you go, the less you're in icing conditions. Excuse me. Very unprofessional there. The only conditions we couldn't operate in would be really heavy rain. Because if the rain got heavy enough, the TFRs could no longer distinguish between terrain and the rain itself, and they would try to climb over it. But rain that heavy would be really, really pretty rare. And most parts of the world, in the United States, that happens fairly often with the kind of climate we have there. But Europe and most parts of the world really don't get that commonly, get really, really heavy rain to the point where we just have to abort. So almost no. We could operate in almost every kind of weather. What is the lure? I don't know how to answer that one, so I'm going to skip the next question. What is, Spade Adam Range. We went there a lot. We did our best. Neil S. talks about that. We did our best overland training at Spade Adam because they're the most realistic ranges. And if I remember correctly, that's where the Top Gear guys launched the Robin Reliant space shuttle, was at Spade Adam Range. For any of you who've seen that episode, it's hilarious. John Ellis asks about Mach 3. I think he's talking about what the real top speed of the airplane is. Yeah, it's true. The airplane requirement was for Mach 2.5, and that's what was published. But the airplane was really at high speed, was thrust. It was not Mach limited. It really didn't have a Mach limit because at wing 72, we didn't have, the wings never went supersonic. And so the F-111D did violate Mexican airspace during an FCF run when I was down there. They were going Mach 3 when that happened and went outside the airspace a little bit. And I know the F-111F could happily do Mach 3 at altitude. The fastest I ever went in the F-111 was at about 42,000 feet, about 1.9 or 2, and really impressed with how hard the airplane could turn at that altitude. At that speed, that altitude, I was, at 42,000 feet pulling 3.5, 4 Gs, and the airplane was perfectly happy with it. So it was, oddly, for an airplane that was most useful at low altitude, it really did pretty darn well at high altitude, too. Did I ever practice wing sweep failure approaches? No. We had an emergency checklist for it, and it did happen on occasion. I think there was a F-111F that had to recover at Lake and Heath that had a 54-degree wing sweep, and he was right at the tire, the limiting speed for the tires when he landed. But it was such a rare thing that in actual practice that the risk of doing it would have greatly exceeded the risk, or of practicing for it would have greatly exceeded the losses that we would have had if we weren't practiced enough, if it happened in the actual event, if it makes sense. Well, we did practice it a lot was because of the wing sweep and the complex flap and slat system that the airplane had. If you ever look at pictures of it, flaps and slats, it looks a lot like an airliner. And that's because they were working every angle they could to get a low approach and landing speed. Far more complicated than anything on a fighter and anything with wings that are subjected to serious bending. Like, F-111, you pull 5 Gs, those wings are bending. And it's bending the mechanisms that run the flaps and slats, too. And we had a fair number of failures in that airplane. I've had asymmetric flaps. I've had a flap asymmetry. I know a guy who had, because he was flying with a new student and had something go wrong, they had all the flaps and slats down on one wing and nothing on the other. And that's bizarre to watch. And so we practiced no flap, no flat, slat, clean wing approaches frequently because they could happen. And the airspeed was so much higher. It was about 200, depending on your airspeed, it was about 200 knots on final. So it was a pretty sporting approach. Let's see. Yeah, I did a fair number of flights using the terrain following radar. This is from Glenn Taller. Mostly in the States for new guys in the airplane. The Western U.S. is, by European standards, empty. And so it was pretty easy to find low-level routes out there where we could fly at night and not risk having people diving under tables and stuff when we went overhead. The interesting thing I didn't mention in the interview about the terrain following radar was that it will fly between any two objects that are further than two wingspans of the airplane apart. So anything less than about 140 feet, two objects 140 feet or more apart, it wouldn't go over them, it would go between them, which is how we could get very often we could be very close to terrain on one side of the airplane because anything more than 60 or 70 feet right or left, the airplane was perfectly happy with it. And so that was always pretty exciting at night. We didn't do it so much in Europe, mostly over Scotland, but we had to be at higher altitudes and it was just too much of a noise issue. So we really didn't get to train as much as we should have done. Zigzags asked about Sidewinder missiles. We carried AIM-9Ps. We carried them during the war. I think, again, that was kind of Operation Frequent Manhood. We wanted to be like the air-to-air guys, but you're never going to employ a heat-seeking missile at night. It just isn't going to happen. And so, it looked cool, but it was not operationally useful. Let's see. Did I ever... Ooh, here's an embarrassing question. Hughes asked me, did I ever bend or break something? Anybody know what the statute of limitations is on this sort of thing? I did. I was coming in off of, we're coming off Jerby Range. And this is when I was a lieutenant, had smoking hair all the time and on fire sometimes. And I was number two. And lead was in a right-hand turn coming off the range. So I come smoking in and do a high to low yo-yo repositioning maneuver to kill some of the geometry. And I still have a lot of time left. I mean, a lot of airspeed left to kill. And so I cross-controlled the airplane, which means I jammed in all the rudder on one end, one direction, and all the stick in the other. And I had completely forgotten about the airspeed limits doing that with the vertical stabilizer. So I got up onto Leeds wing. They look at me with big eyes and say, dude, you're missing part of your tail. Well, got back to the base and realized that my forgetting of airspeed limits and the vertical airspeed and yaw limits of vertical stabilizer, I'd ripped off the entire HF antenna, which was the front, you know, 8 or 10 inches of the vertical stabilizer. So yeah, I bent and broke that. But that's the only thing I'm admitting to, nothing more. Let's see. Ethan asks, what are the most important skills and abilities a military pilot needs to be good at? What helped me the most was I think some people can visualize things in three dimensions better than others. That if you're listening to the radio, you can build up a three-dimensional picture of who's where, of multiple airplanes being in different places. And at the risk of patting myself too much on the back, I think I was pretty good at that. Back in the day, my eyesight was razor sharp, so I could do the impossible and pick out a T-38 at 4 miles. That's way beyond normal visual range. That's a good thing to have. And there has to be, you have to have a pretty good, not sure if a talent's the right word. You really have to be able to compartmentalize. If you did something wrong, you goon something up, you just have to put it in your 6 o'clock and stop thinking about it. Absolutely stop thinking about it, because the easiest thing to do as a human is to dwell on something that's happened in the past and then goon up stuff that's happening in your future. And also, if something happens that scares crap out of you, like I've had it happen a couple times, you just got to act like it didn't happen. I think in that regard, it's to be a fighter pilot, certainly, you kind of have to have the sort of the same skills and attitudes as a professional race car driver, but probably not to the same degree. You don't need them to the same degree that, say, a professional race car driver does, certainly, but you need them in that same direction. Let's see. Did I fly into RAF Lukers in the 80s? I did. I had to do a divert in there once. And let's see. Yeah, so Lukers, I've been in there a couple of times, actually. And I had a divert into, anyway, that was a great place. was I ever punished I never admitted. Hughes has asked me again about the part of the vertical stabilizer I tore off. And my wizzo didn't, I don't think he realized what I'd done. He was kind of new, and they didn't have the same knowledge of aircraft parameters that the pilots did. And of course, the guys in the airplane I was rejoining on, they didn't see it either. So I played dumb, and everybody bought it because it was such a natural act for me. Graham Smith asks if I have any stories, funny stories working with maintenance. Well, I did. I'm not sure if it was funny. I got to an airplane and it wasn't ready to go yet. Like the crew chief just, it was, you know, working as fast as he could and just couldn't get the stuff done fast. And I noticed there was this panel up on top of the airplane, back near the vertical stabilizer, left-hand side, that had a bunch of fasteners that weren't down yet. And so I was like, dude, I know how to run a speed handle. So I climbed up on the airplane and I spun all the fasteners in to get the airplane off center. And So at the time, that wasn't so funny, but I think I posted that picture on Facebook, and boy, did I have maintainers making fun of me. Like, the absolute worst thing you ever want in your maintainer life is a pilot fixing something, because, I mean, they're already bad enough at breaking stuff, and they're not going to make anything worse trying to fix it. So I took a lot of heat on that. Let's see. Jay Priller asked if I have any interest in modern flight simulators. Well, I do have an interest in modern flight simulators, because every time I go back for recurrent training, then I'm in an absolute state-of-the-art level D flight simulator. But that's, you know, the kind of thing that large airlines can buy at $20 million a whack and then operate. So I have interest in them in that sense, and I'm continually amazed at how realistic they've become. Very quickly, Luce, you get so much into that those simulators are so real, you quickly suspend disbelief, and it is just like being in a real airplane. Stress and everything, it's amazing how realistic they are. In an earlier interview, Mirrored Window asked, I decided that why I asked to leave the Air Force. And at the time, I did it because my best friend asked me to go work with him. And it was probably kind of an impulsive move. It certainly wouldn't have been a move I'd have done if I'd been 10 years older. So that was really nothing that had anything to do with the Air Force itself. I loved being in the Air Force. It was every bit of that 20 years, except some of the moments at the Pentagon I could do without. But really, I loved it. But things had really changed by the time I left. Part of it was the collapse of the Soviet Union meant that we did not have a peer symmetric competitor anymore. So we no longer had a really focused mission. We couldn't focus a mission the way we had before. The requirement to go to stealth aircraft and those kind of tactics those airplanes use took a lot of the high adrenaline excitement out of the low-level culture that we were in. And then when I was there, during my operational years, it was a strictly male environment, and we didn't have to take anybody else's sensibilities into account. And so we would have hog logs that we'd just write down stories and stuff. And they were, when women came into the, and I'm not saying, please don't get me wrong here, I don't think people should be barred from anything based solely on their plumbing. And so for women who have the aptitude and desire to fly in fighters, by all means, they need to be there. And by all means, we as men need to understand that women don't think the same way that we do. And if that means we got to act in different ways, then that's the way we have to act. I think the Air Force is, the military has perhaps gone maybe overboard in some of that stuff, but that's really beyond my time. I was doing pilot training by that time, and all I know is guys that talked about who are still operational units. I never had any firsthand notice of it. Dan Breeden asks if we use the main gear as an air brake independently. Yeah, that's what it did. It was a tool. It was a two-purpose door, and that you put a barn door out that big, and it was extremely effective. And you G up the airplane and put the speed brake out, we could lose airspeed like nobody else's business. Hughes asked, was there a crate of beer for the mechanics? When I took off that leading part of the vertical stabilizer, if I'd brought them beer, I'd have been admitting fault, wouldn't I? So no, in that case, I didn't bring beer, but I did mess up in another case where I blew the gear down when I didn't need to. I won't explain why, because it's not that, just takes too much time, but the mechanics ended up having to do a jack and retract on it, and so I went back and bought a case of beer for every guy in the crew. It was a pretty big deal to do that. John Ellis wants to know, the Jedi fly now is the Boeing 757 for for FedEx. Kane asked the engine, what's an engine start like? Well, there's two ways to start the engine. One of them was from external compressed air that would blow through a little turbine that would spin through a gearbox, spin the engine up. And I think we got to 17%. You'd pick up the, this is going way back. I think you picked up the knob of the throttle lever. You pulled it up. And that allowed the air to come in to spin up the engine. When the engine got to 17%, then you pushed the throttle over the idle detent, and that introduced fuel into the engine. And then the fuel would spin the engine up. And then when it got to the right speed, then it would automatically cut out the starter air. The other way we could do it was with a starter cartridge. It would go onto the left engine. You pulled up the left. You armed that, you pulled up the left throttle knob, and then the entire shelter filled with smoke instantly, and it spun that engine up to about 35% in less time it takes to talk about it. And you threw it. That was our quick start, quick reaction start that we did from alert. And we could get both engines started about 30 seconds doing that.
Okay, just to let everyone know, we've got 10 minutes left, so get your questions in.
Let's see. I have one little story I want to tell. So maybe we keep it down to 5 minutes. A story I don't think I got to tell in the interview. John says, I know some female military test. I never flew with any female fighter pilots. I did have a couple women student pilots that I flew check rides with. Formation checks with, and they both wanted to go to, and they were excellent. They were among the top. They were the top two or three grads in the class, and they did go into fighters. So I know that women pilots can have all the qualities that guys do, and I hope nobody interpret anything I said as to anything other than that women who have the capability, desire, equally deserve to fly fighters as men do. Just make sure that's straight. Lone Wolf asked about major upgrades planned for the 111. They had a digital avionics, an avionics modernization program that was going to put digital flight controls in the airplane and inertial INSs, GPS and stuff like that. But with the end of the Cold War, and the force reduction and the F-15E coming on, without a peer competitor, the F-111 really just, as much as I hated to see it go, I really could see that it wasn't really, it had reached the end of its day. Like the Viggen had in the early 80s, the F-111 had had its day by the early 90s. Kane Williams asked if I did an air display. I did. Great story. Don't have time to tell it right now. It's an RAF sealant, and it was a RAF glider club just south of Liverpool, east of Valley, right in that area. And it was RAF glider club, and they set up a bunch of stands and just sent out messages to every unit in NATO, and then just sold tickets, and airplanes flew by, and the audience watched it. And anyways, a whole story that goes beyond that I can't tell right now. I did a couple other, but that was my one where the wizard said we must look great because I thought we were going to die. And then the story I'm going to get to, I think I have my last 5 minutes, was I talked about CND earlier, Companion for Nuclear Disarmament, decided they were going to close RAF Upper Hayford. They're going to encircle it with people so we couldn't get on and off the base. And the wing commander said, okay, fine. All the pilots, all the maintainers, you're going to report to base on Sunday with enough food and snacks enough clothing and snacks to keep you going for a week. We'll provide the food, but you guys have to be able to operate out of your squadrons for a week. And the first day of flying, he said, the moment you get done with your minimum essential training squares, I want you back beating up the field. So just parade the flag. And so the radar pattern was full. The visual pattern was full. And the radar approach control and tower people right on the verge of a nervous breakdown. And I was flying with a student, and I heard somebody call base with gear from the visual pattern. I'm thinking, well, geez, that's about where I am. And I looked, I was in the right seat. I looked to my left, and sure enough, another 10 or 15 seconds, he was going to hit me. He was belly up to me, and he was never going to see me. So unless I did something, we were going to have a midair. Well, really the only safe place to go is to the right. Now, if you've ever been to Upper Hayford, there's a highway that divides the it's kind of the business for the operational side of the airfield from the support side of the airfield. That's a public highway. And that was the road down which most of the demonstrators were standing and closing off the airfield. Well, ordinarily wouldn't go right, but really considering everything, right was a smart way to go. And I'm sure most of you have heard that speed is life, and it is, and that the best way to get speed in the F-111 is to go afterburner, and that really you probably don't want to climb and accelerate at the same time. So I might have gone down the Queens Highway at about 100 feet or so in full afterburner, which under ordinary circumstances would have got me put in prison, but not that day it didn't. So that was one of my most memorable stories for flying Upper Hayford. I hope I was able to catch enough of the questions. It was great fun. Loved doing it. And I really like the interviews you've been put up that I've been watching, Mike. They're really interesting. A lot of interesting people you've been talking to. And I kind of hope that, I didn't let the side down on that one.
Hopefully, if you're willing, you could come back for another live show.
Sure.
That's if I'm sure the guests would love that.
Yeah, sure. Just we'll have to. My calendar's kind of busy for the rest of this month. Not that it's not not that I won't have time, but my time is just all over the place for the next month. So when you think the right time is, drop me a line, and you can have my people call your people, and they'll set something up.
Definitely.
Now, I didn't get the chance to talk about some of the. I talked about the very steep power curve on that airplane, getting behind the power curve, how bad that could be. I didn't get to talk about that much, and there were some difficulties in flying the airplane with that. Anyway, sure, let's do it again.
Absolutely. As you can see from the comments, Jeff, like, people want you back, so let's do it again for sure.
Okay, well, as I say in the pilot business, over and out.